feel off, tired, moody? You might be missing minerals because 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps support energy, mood, and immunity from the inside out. Go to tracemineral.com and feel the difference minerals make. You eat well, you work out, but did you know 99% of Americans are still mineral deficient? That's where Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder comes in. It's your daily foundation for better mood, natural energy, immune support, and nervous system balance. Formulated from nature and backed by science, it's a simple habit that makes a big impact. Because your body doesn't make minerals, and today's food and water don't supply enough, with Concentrace, you'll feel the difference. Go to tracemineral.com and start with minerals. Start with Concentrace.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today's case, wow. I get moved by all crime cases. Every single human being who is lost, or every single human being who is affected by crime, have infinite meaning, of course. But sometimes there are areas of oneself and one's experience that make particular situations feel really personal. And the case that I'm going to cover today is that of Cherish Lily Periwinkle and Donald Smith. And I'm going to say it before I start. And this is not sarcasm. I don't think he should be allowed to keep the name Donald. My father was called Donald, and he was the kindest man you could ever have met. And I feel that Donald Smith has tarnished the name. So excuse me for just referring to him as Smith all the way through this, because he does not deserve to have any relationship with the name Donald, per se. This is going to be a tough one. I'm sure a lot of you know this because you've been asking me again and again to do it. But I also want to make it clear from the get-go that this is recognising this little girl and her meaning at the same point in discussing what actually occurred to her. We always have to say that at the very head of this, it's about remembering Cherish Periwinkle and the fact that before her death, she was a person of infinite value and still will be today, even though she's no longer with us. So she died when she was 8 years old, but prior to this, prior to what I'm going to talk about regarding the death itself, she was a gorgeous little girl. She really was. She was born on Christmas Eve 2004. And in her family group, she lived specifically with her mother, that's Rain Periwinkle. And she also had two younger stepsisters, Destiny and Neve. They were aged 4 and 5. So Cherish was the older sister, the older sibling, teaching those little girls who to be and how to be. They lived in a one-story home that was in Northside, Jacksonville, Florida. And the family struggled to some degree financially. I will put that out there now. We will explore that a little bit further on. But this was, to all intents and purposes, a relatively loving family, without a doubt. Her mother and father, Billy Giroux, had actually separated. So Cherish had been conceived during a one-night stand. Obviously, that means there wasn't a level of commitment between either party. But I also think it says something about Rain, because realistically, there are options when you get pregnant. And Rain wasn't in an incredibly economically privileged situation. The fact that she goes ahead with the pregnancy says something about how she feels about children, full stop, in my opinion. In the UK, if you get pregnant and you have a baby, there are quite a lot of support networks that are available. But I know in America and other areas, it isn't necessarily quite as comfortable in those circumstances. So Rain goes ahead with this pregnancy. Rain was an exotic dancer and Billy was a sailor when they had this connection, shall we say. And Billy had actually later moved to California. And then the pair were very much involved in a custody battle over Cherish. So again, what can we tell from that? Well, they both wanted this little girl, dad and mom, no matter how non-ideal the scenario was regarding the pregnancy occurring. When this little girl became a reality, both loved her, cherished her, as the name would say, and wanted them to have a relationship with her to the point where both wanted to have prime residency. The court appointed an evaluator and you can tell that there are problems in the relationship at that point, nobody wants the courts involved with their experience as a parent. Nobody. If you can keep the courts out of your custody cases, it's going to be a lot easier for you as parents. It can be horrible, horrible to go through that. And when they have an evaluator, it's because people can't decide on what's best for the child as parents. So some independent party comes in and does that for them. Now, that court-appointed evaluator actually recommended that she live with her father. And the reason for that was they felt that Rain had issues, and some of those issues included mental health problems that, in their opinion, made her make some poor decisions. I'm not going to say anything. I appreciate that mental health problems can make people act at times in ways that are not always ideal, but I also think that there can be a real bias when people hear that you have a mental health condition, and that then makes them, from their own place of judgment, make decisions about you based on that prejudice. I'm not saying that was the case. I did also say I wasn't going to say anything about it, but I can't help it because I've worked with too many people who are really great at what they do, but because they have a mental health condition, people hear about it and assume things, even though it's not actually a reality. Just putting it out there, it's a possibility, isn't it? But in spite of this evaluation, the judge in 2010 actually granted the parents shared custody. And that was shared custody with Rain retaining primary custody. But it just supports and substantiates what I'm saying about how wanted this little girl is. The parents fought hard because they wanted to have her in their primary residence. It now seems that after that, Cherish moves in with her mother and her mother's boyfriend, Aaron Pearson. They don't necessarily have the most consistent of experiences where they live. They move to several different places. And at one point, she actually temporarily resided with her mother. She also was in a homeless shelter. So it's not ideal. No matter how much love there is in the situation and circumstance, clearly, it's challenging when you're being met with those kind of transitions. Billy Cherish's father, he described his daughter as a cheerful girl. He said that she had the biggest smile on her face every time you've seen her. Cherish was known to really love the colour pink. She watched Disney movies, cartoons. She used to love having tea parties with her dolls. She enjoyed playing in water. She also really enjoyed going to school. She was at Chaffee Trail Elementary, and she was known by people who loved her or were lucky enough to be involved in her life to be a really happy-go-lucky girl. She was said to have a really kind heart and beautiful eyes, and you just need to look at a photograph of her to see that that is absolutely resonant. She was known to be very close to her mum. There was a very, very good relationship there, and she liked to wear her mum's clothes. They would sit down and watch movies together. And at the age that she was when she died, she'd basically just learned to ride her bike without stabilizers, which on one level is lovely to see that she was reaching those developmental milestones and she was embracing life and she was thriving. On the other, it just brings it home really how young this little girl is, that she just had her stabilizers taken off her bike because she was a little girl. I always feel like I need to do that work of reminding us all about the fact that we're talking about an 8-year-old little girl, angelic, beautiful, kind, known to be compassionate, good at school, all of these markers of potential, and so full of hope. Because no matter how challenging things are for kids in that circumstance where they've got transitions and dysfunction to some degree in where they live, and economically they might not be thriving, the point is, as long as they feel loved, then they can think about a million dreams that are possible. And Cherish would have been in that position psychologically. On Friday the 21st of June, that's 2013, Cherish is basically getting ready to go and visit her father in California. And the reason is that within this custody arrangement, one of the things is that she's going to go and spend the summer with him. So this would be a big deal for Cherish. You know, her and her dad got on very, very well. She's very, very loved. So it's exciting. This is all about preparing for the holidays, right? So she and her mum have spent the whole day just getting everything ready for the trip. And one of the things that they needed to do was they needed to go shopping to get some clothes and other essentials, much like all of us would do with our children the day before they are going on holiday or we are going on holiday. So at this point, Cherish was with her mum and her siblings, and they were at a Dollar General store that was in Jacksonville. Rain, as I've said, didn't have a financially thriving life. So that meant that she didn't have a car, and instead they had to walk the 20-minute journey together. There will be judgments later on about Rain. There will be judgments about her parenting. But at this moment in time, I want everyone to just think about the fact that her daughter needed things for a holiday with her father. Rain didn't absolve responsibility and leave it for her father to sort things out when Cherish arrived. She made an effort all day to get things together that Cherish would benefit from. And then, towards the end of that day, she takes the whole family on a 20-minute walk to get extra essentials. This is the parent who's considered and caring at this moment in time about the child's experience. Now, Rain was struggling, as I said, financially. She had $100 on her at the time. And with that $100, she needed to cover clothes, she needed to get household items, and she needed to get a journey to the airport the next day. So at that moment in time when they're shopping in the Dollar General, they're looking at what they can afford, and she's getting things price checked to see whether she can actually come up with the amount of money that's required. It's during this just very ordinary experience, you know? We've all been there. I was a single mom. I remember things not being affordable and just needing to figure out in your head what was the most essential. And you kind of go into a world where everything is fixated on making sure that you get the right amount of money for the right amount of items, that you don't look embarrassed at the till because you can't afford them. So you're fixated on that. That's your main focus during those circumstances. You're not looking around at what other people are doing. You're not thinking, is somebody watching me? Is somebody scoping me out? Is somebody stalking me and my kids? That's not how it works. You're just focused on the task at hand. So around 7 p.m., they get approached by 56-year-old. I'll say it one more time so you've got the whole name. Donald James Smith. Now, he'd been secretly and completely unbeknownst to Rain watching and listening to them. So,
feel off, tired, moody? You might be missing minerals because 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps support energy, mood, and immunity from the inside out. Go to TraceMinerals.com and feel the difference minerals make.
He had been gathering basic intel on their experience. He'd been listening to Rain explain to a store employee that she couldn't afford to buy a dress for Cherish. And she'd actually put it back. It was a little white dress with red hearts on it. At this point, Smith moves in. Instantly, he's recognized that vulnerability. And he recognizes that if he's kind to Rain, there is a likelihood that he can build rapport quickly. We do that every single day in situations. Anybody who believes that your immediate feeling when somebody talks to you is possible serial killer is just not living on this planet on the whole, or alternatively has experienced something like that before and therefore is primed and ready because of trauma. But for the general non-affected population in that circumstance, your expectation is that most people are nice. Most people are relatively kind. Most people don't wish you harm, because every single day we go through micro interactions where that is absolutely validated and verified by the context and content that we share with other people. So he walks over and starts talking to Rain and to her children. He introduces himself by his first name, and Rain said he genuinely seemed like a really nice man. Smith at this point tells Rain that he's meeting his wife and she has this $100 gift card that's okay to use at Walmart. suddenly he introduces this concept that, hey, you know what? If you come to Walmart with me, well, I'll buy your kids clothes. I'll get your girls some clothes. And on one level, people can say, well, that is creepy behavior. Some random man just walks up to you after seeing you struggling to afford certain items and just steps in like a knight in shining armor. I know that's how a lot of people will feel because hindsight is 20/20. That is always the key. But if you go online and you go on YouTube and you look at random acts of kindness, this stuff is everywhere. I was in Tesco, which is a shop in the UK. They have big ones, supermarkets, and small ones that are local to you. I was in my small one and I was paying for some goods and a woman came over and paid for my shopping. It wasn't like more than 11, 12 pounds, but the point was that's a random act of kindness, completely out of the blue, utterly lovely gesture. And people do these things. And do you believe that the person who's coming to offer you help is going to harm you? Or do you believe that actually they seem like a really lovely person? I'm just going to trust them because good things sometimes happen to good people. It doesn't always have to be that malice is in every interaction. So he's explained to her, one, that he's married. Tick, that is a really effective psychological manipulation. We see this in crimes where, let's put into context, Fred and Rose West. If a woman is involved, Myra Hindley and Ian Brady, when there is a female that is associated with the situation, even one who isn't present, the logistics of that make people think, well, he must be okay because he's got a wife. We're expecting him to fit a paradigm of safety and then we build a picture around it. So he's introduced this mythical wife because he automatically knows that that's going to make Rain feel a little more secure, a little more at peace with potentially agreeing to have these items purchased for her children, purchases that she really, really could do with. So at this point, they wait outside the Dollar General for about 20 minutes, waiting for this wife to arrive. Now, she doesn't materialise, and by this time, it started to rain. Smith then says, look, I've got an idea. I'll drive you to Walmart in my van, and we can meet my wife there. For some of you, that would be big alarm bells. Hang on a minute. I don't know this guy. This guy's wife hasn't turned up. I'm not feeling secure in doing this. And you would have exited at that point. But some people, I'm not saying everybody listening here will agree with this, but some people would feel at this point they've kind of got to know that person a little bit. And there's this desperate need for something that they can give you. And you've been on CCTV in the Dollar General and you've got kids with you. And would this really be the kind of circumstance that somebody who's going to take you away and murder you would use because of the fact that they're going to be so in the spotlight? There are all these things you could kind of quickly make a judgment on. And she makes the wrong judgment. She makes the wrong judgment, absolutely. Before we go any further, we will all agree it was the wrong judgment. But it wasn't a judgment coming from a terrible place. It wasn't a judgment wanting to invite harm for her or anybody else. So in that moment where she has those two options, to walk back home in the rain, that 20 minutes, or take that lift, get that much needed new clothing for her kids, new opportunities for them to look nice, that in itself weighs heavy on her mind. So initially she's reluctant. But ultimately, she decides, I'm going to accept this kind offer. And she tells him, you know, I don't usually go with strangers, but if your wife's coming, then it's okay. So again, building that trust with this idea that he's just normal. He's just a regular guy. He's married. She's just waiting for him. It'll be fine. When you are hard up, when you are financially struggling and somebody gives you an opportunity to have more than you have and that can change in that circumstance, the situation for the better. It's hard to refuse it sometimes. And for her, it was too good to refuse. In fact, for some people, in fact, for many of you, you'll be thinking that sounds too good to be true. And sadly, that is exactly what it was. It was absolutely too good to be true. Because what Rain did not know was that when she was talking to that kind, grey-white-haired stranger who was just being sweet to her and talking about how he wanted to treat her children and get them clothes that they deserved, well, that apparently kind guy was an unmarried, local, registered sex offender. And he had, wow, a proper history of crimes against children. Awful history. So he had prior sex crime convictions in 1977. That was when he exposed himself to a child. Also 1992 and 2009. After the very first conviction, he was evaluated and he was ruled to be mentally disordered. He was considered a mentally disordered sex offender. So, when somebody creates a diagnosis like mentally disordered sex offender, well, the clue is in the title. The job of the authorities when they're working with that kind of an individual is to take that mentally disordered and to make it ordered. To help an individual who has, shall we say, certain impulses, evaluate how they are going to prevent those impulses playing out again and again and again. And once that has been resolved, that individual poses less of a threat to our society. So therefore, of course, if you're going to put somebody in prison with a mentally disordered categorization as a sex offender, it's intense counseling that is required during his time in prison. It is a very specific type of program where he gets to sit in groups with other individuals of a similar belief system and have them challenged, and individual work where the individual working with them as a therapist really connects with whether this person is a full danger. Because if they are, they can create some very tight restraints when they get out of prison. That would be what was meant to happen. But it later transpires that he basically received very little help at all. And I find that not just frustrating, because clearly, if you have somebody who's a dangerous sex offender getting no help when it's been recognised that he needs help, and then that person goes back into society after probably not really enjoying prison, after probably imagining that the one thing that they don't really want to do is go back again, it's going to change the way that you think about committing crimes. And what we know, research-wise, about sex offenders who get caught is that some of them feel that they're not going to ever allow themselves to be caught in the way that they have prior to this, such as, let's never leave a witness. You kill the witness, well, that's going to give you more opportunity to escape, isn't it? So you're sending out somebody who's already ultimately very dangerous, but now they're schooled in what they want to avoid. And I think that this case fits that kind of paradigm. And it makes me really angry because we're talking about some of the most dangerous human beings that walk our planet. We're talking about predators who prey on little children. And these individuals who we know have a predilection, who we know aren't just going to remove their attraction for children. They are returned to our society, not only not having improved, but even worse than when they entered the system. And that is what we're talking about when we think about individuals such as Smith. Knowing that he was given no help, inexcusable. Inexcusable. He also lived non-independently to some degree because he was still living with his mother. So this facade that he's created with Rain about him being married and so on and so forth is just patently untrue. She's in her 80s and she lives in a home that has been owned by her for decades, and he literally lives with her. And that property was literally within walking distance from DuPont Middle School. I know. Let's release you. What are the important things that we remember with this sex offender? Well, we don't want him near kids. I agree. We should prevent him ever having access to children. How can we do that? Well, we should just make sure he's released directly near to a school. That will work. Said no probation officer ever in their right mind. To me, it is shocking, but nonetheless, this happened. That's where he's living at the time. There was no restriction on his license about him living close to a school. And it seems like the distinction for this is because even though he's a registered sexual offender, that doesn't apparently make him a sexual predator. Okay, he just exposes himself to kids. But that's not predatory at all. That's just a bit offensive. That's an offensive thing to do. It's not a predatory thing to do. What a pile of bubbles. Of course he's a sexual predator. Anybody who exposes themselves per se is a sexual predator. There's no light exposing yourself. Oh, I'm just having a bit of fun, just exposing myself. It is predatory behaviour that often escalates to reprehensible actions and preventable outcomes if they're dealt with initially. Now, Smith, bizarrely, had managed to have a child from a previous relationship. So he had, at some point, managed to hold down a relationship with a female enough to impregnate her. But that was the total sum parts of his life of experience within relationships per se. When he wasn't incarcerated as well, Smith managed to portray himself as a pretty nice guy. Yeah, pretty nice guy is what local residents actually said. They described him as appearing to be like neighbour of the year. That was on the surface because he was a painting contractor, he was a handyman, but because they knew of his past and his true nature, they also acknowledged that he was somebody who was very odd. Is it just me who would have been like, hang on a minute, you might be a great painter and decorator, I don't know, you might be able to do my home over beautifully. People might walk in and be like, the way your skirting boards have been painted makes me want to enter a competition for you of skirting boards. That would never happen, would it? Because if there was a sex offender on my row of houses, I think that I would likely, well, definitely not speak to him, but likely have a petition. A large petition where I would stand outside his home, in this case his mother's home, with large placards saying, pervert, leave. And I'd get people to sign it so that even if people thought that he looked nice on the surface, everybody would know that this man was a pervert because my placards would demonstrate said pervert title. I have an issue, guys, with sex offenders. That's why I don't work with them. I find sex offenders deeply troubling and I would not want them on my row or certainly not in my home painting my walls, no matter how handy he was. Well, he was handy, wasn't he? In the past, he was one of those people who got handy with inappropriate things in front of kids. Ugh. But even though they knew about his past and that gave them a level of guard, they also could see that he was quite manipulative because he was somebody who could just fit in and seem like a nice guy. Nice guy. It's also worth talking about some failures that are going to come up in this case because, again, a lot of you are going to be sitting here not knowing some of this information and feeling really frustrated about the whole how this murder plays out. And there were things that I found that really affected me knowing, and a few of the things involved the fact that it transpired that two people had actually contacted Crime Stoppers and reported Smith, because Smith had just got out of prison when he kills Cherish. So there had been these reports. Now the first had come from a call 10 days earlier. And the caller had literally seen Smith in a Walmart in the Villages in Central Florida. And it was his body language that really concerned them. He looked fidgety. He kept wandering the store aisles, clearly scoping out potential victims. So people saw that and were very disconcerted by it and literally called Crime Stoppers, which, it's so annoying. That's a hero. That is a hero. The person who made that call was not just able to intuitively think there is something wrong with this human being, there is something wrong about this behavior. They were compelled to pick up the phone and to report him. Should have ended there, shouldn't it? Not appropriate behavior. People should have been thinking, we need to check this individual out for all the right reasons. And the second call, which I think is just unforgivable that there are two calls made, this is on the same night that he approached Rain and her kids. A caller had seen Smith and he was hiding behind a woman's clothes rack on his mobile. So there he is behind the women's clothes, potentially filming. Again, this is not typical behavior. Why is he in the women's section and why is he filming? That in itself should have provoked a reaction. That is not normal experience in any kind of store. Now, Smith had actually been arrested for the last time in 2009, and it was unbelievable, the grandiose system that must have been going on in this man's mind at this moment in time. I mean, he was steadfast on harming kids, absolutely, because what I'm about to tell you is absolutely terrifying, that he would go to these lengths, and also that he was such a manipulator that he could create what plays out. And on top of that, what does it say about how far he is willing to go to get contact with children? So in 2009, when he gets arrested, he was arrested for impersonating a Department of Children and Services official. And he makes obscene and threatening calls basically to this 9-year-old girl.
Feel off, tired, moody? You might be missing minerals because 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps support energy, mood, and immunity from the inside out. Go to TraceMinerals.com and feel the difference minerals make.
Even calls her 12-year-old brother on his mobile and asks to speak to his sister. He knew her name, so instantly, her brother would think that this was somebody who had a valid reason to be calling. So the boy gives Smith his mother's mobile number. This point, Smith calls her, says that he's with child services, says he's conducting an investigation concerning her daughter. You get a call off somebody who has your number, who says that there's an investigation around your daughter, you are going to be blindsided. You are not really going to know what's playing out, but you're certainly not wanting to provoke social services in this moment because you want to make sure that you seem like a good parent. So that confusion enough is going to affect you to a point where you might make agreements that on reflection probably weren't the best thing to do. At the time of that phone call to the mother, the girl that is in question is visiting the grandparents at the time. So he manages to get their number. And he calls them. They allow this little girl to speak with him for about 20 minutes. Of course, remember, they are on the back foot. They think that the reason there is a call happening is for good reason, and this man is an employee of the government. But for 20 minutes, he had a dirty phone call with that little girl. He asked about whether she wore a bra. He asked what her private parts look like. And then he gets back on the phone to the grandmother and manages to convince that grandmother that the girl's father and grandfather had been suspected of molesting her. He then threatens that if she tells anyone of their conversation, she could basically go to jail. Now, on one level, a lot of you will think, well, that's crazy. No one would actually take that call seriously. Why on earth would you believe somebody who's saying you can't even tell somebody about this phone call? And it's so serious that if you do, you might actually lose your freedom. But then think about the last few years and how irrational some people have been because they've been scared. Fear is a massive motivator in compliance. So in this moment, she's had the mum on the phone. Now she's got this guy threatening her on the phone. She's being told that the child is potentially being molested. She's very confused. And he tells her she actually needs to bring the girl to McDonald's so he could examine her. He even says to the grandmother, I don't want you to come in with the girl. You stay in the car park. She then takes the girl inside as instructed, but being asked to stay in the car park is the alarm bell. And she doesn't. She waits inside McDonald's with the child. Thank God she did. But at that point, she obviously recognised that if this is an official, there's no way that they would want to see my child, my granddaughter, by themselves. And because of that, Smith didn't actually appear. Clearly, when this girl's family have got a moment to just reflect on how insane that story sounds, they put the pieces of the jigsaw together. They're very disturbed by it. And they realise that somebody has tried to pull the wool over their eyes, and they then go in and hand the number that they've got of Smith's to the police. They trace him, they arrest him. Now, shockingly, that case ended in 2012, and I'll tell you why. The defence somehow successfully arranged a plea bargain, guilty plea, to charges that literally only carried 14 months behind bars. So, as opposed to it going to a big trial, as opposed to a judge and jury being able to sentence accordingly with this shockingly terrifying behaviour, they just managed to reduce it. We're talking 14 months. You get more for a DUI often. You certainly get more for things like shoplifting and drug offences. This guy was trying to assault and molest a little girl after constructing a fabrication and lie to the family of such a degree that he almost got access to her. And that's the best case scenario, that he just wanted to molest her. The fact that he wanted that child going to McDonald's by herself means that likely he didn't want the family to recognise him. And what if he had then abducted her? We don't know what his plan was, but certainly there was malice behind it. During this investigation, the police actually speak to Smith's mother, who was like, you know what? He's a massive pervert. He's a child molesting paedophile. I don't want him home. In fact, I am moving from my house that I have been decades in, and I myself will be using some of the wood from the house to make placards about my own son. And I will be standing with Emma Kenny on the other side of the road, suggesting that he is evicted immediately. Didn't happen. Of course it didn't happen. Did in my little fantasy. In my little fantasy, that's how every parent of a sick person should respond in these circumstances. But she's in denial. And she stated that he would never prey on a child. This is what she specifically said. He's never touched a child. He's just never around children. Children are just not his thing. Anyone who has to say out loud, children are just not his thing, seems to be protesting in a way that no one should ever have to, because yeah, for any adult, children should not be their thing unless that adult is working with children, protecting children and looking after their interests, in which case, okay, children can be their thing in an appropriate way. But that deflection is clearly coming from a place of defense, because in the same conversation, she actually referred to his 1992 arrest and said this: I am right that he had been using drugs, and I guess there was an exposure. He exposed himself to a child. Didn't touch the child, but it was a child that was in the area where he was living. The child reported the description of whatever he was driving at the time. I cannot even begin to break that down to a point where it could ever make any sense, because we all know what she's getting across there. She's like, well, you know, he was just in the area with his cock out, and at the end of the day, you know, kid was there and they just happened to see him, but he wasn't really a massive predator preying on an innocent kid and traumatizing them. No, the kid just happens to be in the wrong time at the wrong place whilst my son had his penis out. Ooh. The minimization is so dangerous, because if the people who love you do not make you feel responsible and accountable for your actions, there are no consequences. Because you can always find a place of denial. You can always find a foundation of support to support the absolute unsupportable, the absolute unforgivable. So this guy likes harming kids and sexually has an absolute affinity and predilection with children. Smith also had previously served time for attempting to kidnap and sexually assault minors. What is this man doing being allowed out of prison, let alone with 1 mile of being near a children? So, yeah, on one occasion he attempts to lure a 13-year-old girl into his van, and she actually tries to get away and he chases her. Literally chases her. On another occasion, he tries to lure 2 girls into his van and he's got pornographic magazines, which again makes you think that this was a man who had very little understanding of what children and young people would ever be interested in. I mean, if you want to lure girls into a van, I'm just going to throw it out there. Pornographic material is probably the thing that will make them run screaming from where you are, and rightly so. But demonstrates, doesn't it, this complete lack of boundaries and seeing kids as sexual objects. And the fact that he believes they'd be interested in that, he's leveling the relationship. He's making them sexual. He's making them a part of his fantasy whereby he believes that they want it. That's how he's working that through. These are girls. They're going to be interested in pornographic material because, you know, they're sexual beings and I want to have sex with them. It's so warped and screwed up. And again, at the end of the day, they get away because they have the wherewithal to know that this guy is a creep. At this point, he's sentenced to 5 years. Also, it's worth noting that in his local area, people who knew him said that he had this real history of just driving around in his van and going out of his way to show young girls pornography, which is deeply traumatizing for them. I do not know how he was ever allowed out of his cell. I really don't. In 2002, Smith's former psychologist, they actually described Smith as a clear and present danger to children in the community. A clear and present danger to children and the community. Yeah? And what did they do with that information? Authorities did nothing. Those concerns were not heeded. So here we have an absolute professional who knows exactly what Smith's mindset is and has grave concerns about this, and they get ignored too. When Smith murders Cherish, he had been on release from prison on the 31st of May for just 3 weeks. 3 weeks. When he meets Rain, he has literally only just become part of that community again. Obviously, Rain and her unsuspecting family have absolutely no idea that this man is a terrifying child molester, a predator, a horrific human being. And if it's not bad enough that he's just been released, that morning, literally that morning, they had done a routine address check because clearly they needed to know where he was. So the police had been involved with him that very morning, which tells a very serious story, doesn't it? It does not perturb him. The fact that they've gone and checked on where he is and that he's still at that address, it hasn't provoked a response from him. It hasn't made him go, right, well, what I really need to do is to think about my behaviour because, you know, I am on licence. No, he doesn't care. It's not presented any issue for him whatsoever. Days after he was released in May, there is something that he did do. He actually went and checked himself in at UF Health Jacksonville, and he did that apparently for help. He gets sent home with a list of names at that point for appointments. It seems, sadly though, in the interim between him asking for this help and getting appointments, he comes across the Periwinkles. Arguably, was it that he realised that he was a ticking time bomb? Was it that he himself knew that he was going to do something reprehensible and permanently damaging to children if he was allowed to go unchecked? Possibly. I feel like I'm giving him too much credit there. I don't really think that he's the kind of human being who has this kind of conscience. But nonetheless, he may have been aware of an escalation in his desires and hoped that in spite of the fact that he had this escalation that was taking him on a very dark path, that if he could get some kind of intervention, whilst it wouldn't quash the predilection, it may be enough to stop him going ahead with his darkest and most reprehensible malevolent desires. Once Smith, Rain and the girls arrive at Walmart, he says he's going to wait for his wife in the car park. This is important because clearly he's trying to get across to Rain that there's nothing to be afraid of. You know, he's obviously not a predator, otherwise he'd be following them around, right? He wouldn't be letting them out of his sight. So I'm just gonna stay here. I'm just gonna wait for my wife. I'm gonna make this story seem plausible. In the meantime, Rain now is probably buoyed by this and is thinking to herself, wow, I've actually got really lucky. This man is a knight in shining armor, and I'm going to be able to get the things that I really need for my daughters. So off she goes. Shortly after, Smith joins them. This is when they're in the children's clothing section, and he doesn't actually buy anything for himself aside from a bundle of rope. Yeah, he buys a bundle of rope. You can just imagine what's going through his head when he does that. Another thing that is very uncomfortable is he actually picks out a pair of shoes for Cherish, and they are utterly inappropriate for a kid. They were high-heeled woman's shoes, and at the end of the day, he's rebuffed by Rain. She says that she wouldn't even wear them. But what does that tell you? What does it suggest is going on in his head? And the fact is that he doesn't seem to have a problem with the fact that he's suggesting that this little tiny girl should be wearing these really high-heeled, inappropriate shoes. So even though he's trying to act in the guise of this kind gentleman, the predator is just slipping through. And again, that's telling us that he's struggling to control his desires, because that's a dead giveaway on one level, sexualizing a child, looking at shoes that are completely inappropriate and connecting them with a little girl. So essentially, he's not able to contain those feelings at this moment in time. Also, disturbingly, he takes Cherish to the changing rooms alone on two occasions. I know it's an error of judgment without a doubt on Rain's part that she allows this weirdo to just take a child to the changing rooms. But again, they're in a store. She's bought into this belief it's all going to be all right. He's just a nice man. And she's imagining without a doubt that nothing bad could happen to her in the changing rooms, because that's how people think, even though we all know it takes only a moment for something tragic to happen. And changing rooms are secluded and they do allow people access to whoever they want access to if that person is taking that individual to that place. So that is a definite error of judgment. But what does it also tell you? Well, it tells you that he brings her back. So now Rain has evidence that he can walk off with her child and that child can come back safe and sound, or at least looking safe and sound. They spend a few hours shopping in Walmart, and it gets to the point where the store is closing, and it's been a long day for Rain and her kids. They haven't had any food. They've walked quite a distance, and these are little kids, right? So they're gonna get a bit narky. They're gonna be overtired, a bit overwhelmed. They might get a bit emotional. This is completely normal behavior for children who are overtired. So he again steps in, doesn't he? And bear in mind, they've been together a while now. Rain has probably dropped her guard. Nothing terrible's happened. He's been happily allowing her to just pick items up that she will feel in that moment, feel a bit life-changing for her and the kids. And Smith suddenly says, I'm gonna buy some cheeseburgers for us all. You know, I'll get Cherish and her sisters this food. It's gonna be fine. It's about 10:30 p.m., so it was late. And there was a McDonald's in the store. So Smith walks away and 8-year-old Cherish quickly follows him. Rain at this point on reflection, when she's asked about why she let him go and go with her daughter, she just says that she thought that she'd be safe. McDonald's was located in the actual store. There were plenty of people around. It was light in the store. She didn't feel that there was anything untoward that could possibly happen at that moment in time. But that view, that moment that that little girl of hers runs after that man, that's the last time she sees Cherish alive. Because instead of taking Cherish to McDonald's, Smith walks her out of the store into the car park, and then the surveillance cameras capture them leaving the store at 10:44 p.m. She was skipping. Yeah, skipping and holding Smith's hand. Because this guy has become a trusted party to her. She's had fun. He's bought them clothes as far as she's concerned. They're getting food. She doesn't know the man who goes to the McDonald's in the shop. She just blindly trusts, naively trusts, innocently trusts this adult. And in her experience, adults can be trusted. That's the most painful thing of these circumstances, is that a child trusts adults, because adults on the whole are very easy to trust because they are good to children. Kids don't realise that there are these bastards inhabiting the shadows. They get into his van and they're seen on CCTV driving away. 20 minutes later, Cherish's mum realises the absence. You know, she knows that they've gone to McDonald's. She knows that they're going to be getting some food, and it's 20 minutes. That seems a little bit too long for comfort. She looks around. She starts to panic because she can see that her daughter isn't present. By 11 o'clock, they're still not returned, and the store is closing at this point. Now, she actually had a shopping trolley full of clothes, and remember, she's got no money. So all that time that she's spent getting things because she wants to treat her kids by this kind gesture, it's come to nothing. There's no sign of Smith. There's no sign of his wife. Most importantly, there's no sign of her daughter, Cherish. She then gets herself together and she goes over to McDonald's because she wants to know whether they're just still waiting around there. And chillingly, McDonald's is closed. She gets searching frantically. Look all over the store, looks all over the car park. That takes about 20 minutes. And then, desperate, she borrows a employee of the store's mobile phone and she contacts the police. It's at 11:18 p.m. At this point, she says, "My daughter has been abducted." She tells the police what she fears. And she actually says this: "I should have told him no, but my girls needed clothes so bad. I'm so sorry. I hope to God he doesn't kill her. And I hope to God he doesn't rape her. I'm hoping he's not raping her right now, because I've had that done to me and it's not fun."
"I met a man today at Dollar General. He saw that I was struggling to buy them some clothes. He drove us here to buy us some clothes. And the only reason I went with him because he said his wife was going to be here. I had a strange feeling about him when I first met him. And he took her to the dressing room twice. And I was hoping that she would be okay. And I was looking at the shoes. And I didn't want him to think that I was overly protective."
That 911 call is devastating to listen to, because Rain is both present and in the past in that situation. And she is in that moment somebody who is dealing with her daughter and the fear of what's happening to her daughter and the pain that she knows her daughter would be involved in if that were happening to her because of her personal experience. It's awful, because you can just hear the dread in her voice. I said you would be frustrated, and you were going to get more frustrated when I talk about what plays out, because there were massive mistakes at this point. The 911 dispatch handler just clearly had a bias when they took that call. And there were crucial delays following Rain's call to emergency services, because that handler had concluded that things that were said during the call were basically not rational for a mum whose daughter had suspectedly been abducted. What they actually felt was there was a lack of authenticity to the call. Yeah. So a little girl has just been taken from the store by a man. And when 911 were called, the individual, because they didn't like the way that she said it, decided that it probably wasn't real. that slowing down of the investigation is catastrophic. So when the call handler actually relays the details to the police, she literally omitted concerns that Rain had expressed about her daughter being raped and murdered. And that meant that the matter was designated as a Signal 8, that's a missing persons case, instead of a more serious Signal 30, which is a kidnapping case. Now, in that situation, when somebody gets a Signal 30, it's a really big reaction because it requires officers to automatically contact the media. So this is what you do. We have a child, potentially abducted, potentially in grave danger. You get out there straight away. It's everywhere because you want the public to be able to help. So in turn, if that had happened, the police would have been able to get local outlets to alert the public through the TV, the internet, social media. The public would have been on the lookout because they would have been thinking that Cherish was in danger, and they would have seen that there was a reason to look out for Smith's van and a man who was meeting that description of Smith. So this doesn't happen. In fact, that failure to alert the media continues throughout the night. If it isn't bad enough that what I'm telling you actually happened, officers later on actually doubted that Rain was being genuine at all. Yeah. They decided that because there had been a custody battle and Rain was in a situation where her daughter was flying out to be with her dad the next morning, that clearly it was a potential that she was just making this difficult so that she wouldn't have to see her daughter travel to her father's the next day, even though she was out shopping for items to make the trip nicer for her daughter. But they believed that potentially the explanation was that she was hiding the child from her father. I mean, sorry, it drives me mad. But if you didn't want to send your kid because you wanted to keep hold of them, you would just keep hold of them. Yeah, it might lead to some issues. You might get into a bit of trouble, but chances are that's going to get you in a lot less trouble than pretending there's been an abduction of.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Your daughter. Why the police would jump to that conclusion, I have no idea. They said that when they watched her talking about the fact that her daughter had been abducted, she was crying and she was moaning, but she didn't shed any tears. Again, I think likely that she just looked absolutely lost, stunned, shocked, terrified, and maybe she didn't cry as much as they would have liked her to, but not everybody cries instantly because they're in absolute shock. Or it might be that your bias is so much in that moment that you judge that she isn't crying even though she was. Also, she said that she was psychic and she said that she could help find missing persons. And then she commented that when they did find her daughter, they would bring her back in a box. So again, that makes them think that she's making things up. It doesn't make them consider that potentially she is psychic, and everybody's got their different opinions about that. I don't know. Things like that are possible, I guess. And certainly the fact that she imagines that her daughter's going to be brought back in a box is something that becomes horribly true. The case was not even designated a kidnapping until 2:15 a.m. That is 3 hours after Cherish had vanished. That's 2 hours after the police had literally sat and watched video surveillance of Smith leaving Walmart with Cherish. Yeah. With a known sex offender. Just do a bit of research. It ultimately, for me, feels like the call handler and the police just jumped to lots of unjustified conclusions, and those unjustified conclusions absolutely were the nail in the coffin. They helped to seal Cherish's fate without a doubt. Those police delays meant that the Amber Alert wasn't put out for a long period of time. And think about the fact that when a child goes missing, it has to be instant because children get horribly murdered quickly in these situations. So if you want to stop something dreadful befalling a child, you need to get it out of there straight away. It took 7 hours from her being reported missing before that Amber Alert went out. Now, when a child goes missing, as I've said, time is of the essence. And with respect, most are found within 72 hours. Furthermore, chances of a successful recovery do increase greatly when the images of the child are released to the public as soon as possible. This is all about the Amber Alert system, because they've realised that the more you get stuff out there, the more people feel part of that investigation, the more diligent people come when they're looking around, the more likely they are going to report when they see somebody meeting and matching that description. And in certain cases, people have actually followed abductors and managed to get the police to secure an arrest and bring back that child safely because they have been so invested in the process. That Amber Alert is named after 9-year-old Amber Hagerman. And she was abducted and she was murdered in Arlington, Texas in 1996. And she basically was just going about her business and she got forcefully dragged into a black pickup truck. Sadly, her body was found. She never survived that. She was found in a creek and her throat had been cut. Actually, ironically, the killer has never even been brought to justice. But because of that little girl's legacy, 579 children's lives have been saved since the Amber Alert system was introduced in 1996. And I can't say for definite that Cherish Periwinkle would have survived if they had taken her missing alert seriously. But I don't believe for 1 minute that that little girl got the right amount of diligence and attention paid to her. She was a kid. And they just thought it might be some kind of weird custody battle. My belief is this: if there is any slight breath of potential that a child is being placed in a position of heinous harm, use the resources. If you find out afterwards it turns like you've got some mother who's just making this stuff up, she'll pay her price. She'll pay her price. But do not take a risk with these things. The police end up, of course, taking it seriously, and they get helicopters out, they get ground units out. They can't find a trace of Smith and Cherish. They also start looking for Smith's vehicle. It's a 1998 white Dodge van with Florida plates, and it's got a 2-inch dark pinstripe down its sides, so I guess it's relatively recognizable. On Saturday morning, that's the 22nd of June, 2013, a traffic officer is going about his business, is basically attending a roadside traffic accident, and suddenly recognises Smith's van. It's travelling on Interstate 95. This point clearly calls it in. Highway gets shut down and the exits get blocked. Officer then surrounds Smith's white van. When they apprehend him, it's really weird because his trousers were soaking wet. shoes are covered in mud. And at this point, he's taken into custody by Jacksonville Sheriff's Officer around 9 a.m. They also know he's covered in scratches. Covered in scratches. In the back of his van, officers find items that Rain had purchased at the Dollar General store, so they instantly can link that this is the man they're looking for. They then get him to the station, start asking him questions. Initially, he refuses to answer any questions. Of course he does, because he's a massive egomaniac who wants to control the situation. Later on, he does speak and he says, yeah, I don't know anything about Cherish. I don't know anything about Cherish. You literally have the items in the back of your van that were for her. And also, why are you half wet and covered in mud? And he's like, just spent the night smoking crack with prostitutes. Now, even though we all know that's absolute bull, psychologically, what will happen with criminals, they will often do this. They will offer something that says, why would I be admitting to doing something illegal to officers unless I was telling the truth? And that's what he does. He introduces this sub-story where, okay, the reason I didn't say anything was because, hey, I was breaking the law. I was having sex with prostitutes while smoking a very serious drug. It's a way of deflecting. It doesn't work because officers are like, well, that's an interesting theory, but we literally have footage of you leaving Walmart with Cherish. He then realizes that he's got to concoct another story. Of course he has. Now he's banged to rights, isn't he? They've literally got him on video with this gorgeous little girl being taken in the van. Then he says, okay, I did. I took her. But the truth is, after she got in the van, she basically jumped out at a red light. You know, like most kids. I mean, we have to have those child safety locks on our cars because children are always just exiting our vehicles whenever there's a red light. I mean, zebra crossings. In fact, anything that involves your car stopping, you have to stop those little blighters just getting out and running for the hills, said no parent ever. But this is what he decides is going to construct an appropriate alibi. At this point, he also says, I need to speak to a lawyer. You're like, yeah, you do. You definitely need to speak to a lawyer. Although I have an easier way of dealing with this. I just be like, just tell them what you did, you perverted, child molesting piece of work. Just let's do that. Let's save any need to go through anything other than a straight guilty verdict of whatever you've done. Obviously, that's never how it plays out, but that's how I would have it play out. Around the same time that he's having that conversation with the police, they actually get a call from a local resident. They've seen that the Amber Alert is now out. They've read this news report about a missing child, and they had actually noticed earlier on that they'd seen what they considered was a suspicious vehicle. It's parked near a wooded area off Broward Road. It was a white van, so it meets this description. So the police immediately begin searching the area, and they've got canine units, they've got the dogs out there. And really sadly, really tragically, and unbelievably when you think about what I've told you regarding missed opportunities, they basically very quickly find Cherish's half-naked body shortly before 10 a.m. So they recover her very, very quickly. They know it's her even before she needs to be identified, because she's basically wearing the same orange dress that they'd seen her in on the surveillance video. Wow. That little girl, that gorgeous, beautiful little girl, she had met a tragic end. She'd been brutally raped. She'd been sodomized. And she'd been strangled to death. Smith had gagged her so severely, so violently, that her gums had bled. And she'd been strangled with a piece of clothing with such ferocity that the skin had been stripped from her throat. And then her body had been submerged in a creek off the Trout River that was behind Highlands Baptist Church. It also explains, of course, why Smith was soaking from the waist down when he was apprehended by the police. Smith had actually gone to great lengths to try to submerge her body because he didn't want to get found, without a doubt. He didn't want to be connected with this crime, even though obviously he wasn't sophisticated in any way, shape or form in the way that he'd acted forensically. At this point, clearly he doesn't want the idea of a body to, shall we say, mean that he's brought in without any potential of getting off this particular charge. If there's no body, it makes it very difficult, doesn't it? The story of her getting out and running off at a red light might be something that he can play out long enough. And remember, if there aren't forensic opportunities because body has decayed to a point where they can't tell why somebody's died, well, that does make prosecution more difficult. Think about stories that we know, like Casey Anthony and how she got off. But Smith had basically attempted to hide poor Cherish's body under a log with bricks, cement, all the material as well. And he'd weighed her body down with chunks of asphalt in 6 inches of water. He would definitely have been hoping that the DNA evidence was washed away before her body would get found. Whilst the crime scene was examined for evidence, an officer actually stood by her body because he wanted to make sure that it wasn't eaten by alligators, because that is another thing that could have occurred. So they wanted to make sure that the whole of the crime scene was protected. At this point, Smith is rightfully charged with kidnapping, sexual battery of a person under 12, and also, the most important here, is first-degree murder. When news of what had happened to this gorgeous little girl got out, the local community were absolutely stunned. And the reason for that is, in this area, violent crime was a rarity. And when you think about, we're talking a violent crime involving this very young child, that was incredibly rare. They were really supportive. They went out of their way to support Cherish's utterly grief-stricken family. Strangers called the house. They came by with food. They dropped groceries off. And hundreds, and I mean hundreds, of people attended Cherish's funeral in June 2013. It was so important to the local community that they were part of it, that they actually put it on TV. So on local TV, it was shown so that the people who couldn't make it, couldn't fit in the church, etc., could feel that they had a connection to this child that had been taken from them. Cherish's funeral had a visitor's book, a guest book, to basically record who went. 2,000 people signed that guest book. That little girl meant so much to people that she'll never know, people that she'll never meet, but she stained their hearts, and they came from far and wide to make sure that they paid their respects. It always makes me feel that juxtaposition to what it will be like when Smith dies, a pauper's funeral, no doubt. No one will turn up for him, will they? He won't be remembered for anything other than the disgraceful, reprehensible, murderous behaviour. I digress. My anger takes over sometimes in cases like this. We all know I'm very badly triggered when it comes down to child abuse and murder. Smith has to make a decision about which way he's going to plea, and obviously he's going to go guilty because there's so much damning evidence against him, isn't there? The video tape of him leaving Walmart with Cherish, the fact that his van's got lots of forensic evidence, the fact that people have spotted him in the place where she was found, the fact that he concocted all of these lies to create this fabrication. This is all evidence, isn't it? So he goes not guilty to all charges. At this point, I'm not going to lie, I do feel that medication that makes you tell the truth could be something that should be introduced to certain circumstances like this. The fact that he wants to put the family through a trial. What a narcissist. So it gets to court in 2018. His defense team are worried that he's not going to get a fair trial. They're not worried that he's not going to get a fair trial because he's a prolific child molesting murderer who deserves to literally never walk our streets again and ideally be kept in a very small cell in complete discomfort until he takes his last breath.
No, they're not concerned about that. They think he won't get a fair trial because of the extensive media coverage of the case. Do you mean the extensive media coverage where literally they discuss what he did to that innocent child? That media coverage? Yeah, that major coverage. You mean the coverage that's true? Well, I mean, it's true, but is it fair? Yeah, it's more than fair. I'd have a let's find him guilty just online. Let's just have a vote. If we agree that he's guilty, go guilty, save a lot of money on the trial, but you'll get the general gist that we all know that we're not having the wool pulled over our eyes and he's a murderer who needs to go to prison immediately. But no, they're like, he won't get a fair trial. There's been too much coverage of this case. Also, because it had been widely discussed on social media, they were saying that ultimately a jury would have bias. Understandably, when you look online about how Smith had been discussed, I think the word monster is probably underplaying it. Turns out you, me, and in general, we really don't like paedophile child molesters, and we certainly hate paedophile child killers. So this has all been discussed online and you can look at some of those, shall we say, suggestions of what you would consider this kind of human being to be titled with. And there were a lot of calls for him to be executed. I wonder why. I wonder why people would want somebody who's been a prolific child molester, tried to abduct many children and eventually killed an innocent kid. I wonder why people would want him executed. Also, the details of his past convictions had been extensively broadcast. Now, I will agree that even though I think anything that could put this kind of human being away forever is important to be shared, because arguably we don't want people like this walking the streets, it is a problem when people share details that are not meant to be revealed to the jury, because the likelihood is it would cause some kind of prejudice, even when it's deserved. Because past convictions, they're only meant to be considered by the judge when the judge sentences. So if the defence believe that his guilt has been decided before the case has even been heard, then they will feel that that is unfair to him. I know, none of us want any justice for this guy anyway, but they're doing the job. So they apply to change the venue and it's denied. They're like, I don't think any venue is going to kind of feel that being fair to this monster is an appropriate usage of our time. I just think, let's just stay here where everyone can't stand him, as opposed to going there where everyone won't be able to stand him. So they open the trial. At this point, the prosecution tells the court, every mother's darkest nightmare became Rain Periwinkle's reality. During that trial, the defence sought to have Cherish's harrowing autopsy photos excluded as evidence. And the reason for this is they argue that the emotional impact that they would have on the jury would outweigh their evidential value. It's a whole heap of crazy, this, to me. Honestly, it's a whole heap of crazy. The idea that the very pictures that were taken of this poor child's violated body would cause distress to a jury who had to make a decision as to whether this said child's horrifically violated body was deserving of finding the perpetrator guilty of first degree murder. The idea that that is a bias that shouldn't be introduced is nonsensical. It's a trial about what happened. So you should absolutely go ahead, see the evidence, and make your decision based on their evidential value, which evidently says this guy needs to rot in jail forever. So that makes no sense to me. But their argument was, well, the pathologist is actually coming in to give the evidence, so you don't need to see the actual pictures. Again, I like whoever was making these decisions. The request was denied. And rightly so, many of the jurors were absolutely in pieces when they had to view the 26 images. And I've watched the pathologist giving evidence and she is struggling. And when I'm listening, I am struggling and you will struggle because we care deeply for this child. We may never meet her or know her, but we can feel her loss and we can feel the horror of what played out in her final moments that no child should ever be subjected to. Whilst those images were shown, Smith just turned his back, just wasn't interested. This is who he is. There's no accountability and responsibility, no remorse. He just is telling you, I'm not interested. Don't get confused. He's not doing it because he's struggling. He knows what he did. He lived it out in 360. He's not traumatized by it. He's letting you know, I am disinterested. She means nothing. If ever you could imagine how a psychopathic, narcissistic murderer would act, it's in that moment. She is negligible. She is rubbish to be thrown out, to be discarded. That's what he's getting across in his action, in his body language. The nature of those injuries that that little girl suffered was so horrific that, as I said, this experienced pathologist who's very professional, very able, eloquently to describe what happened quietly, she's very informed, she literally struggles to get them out. She detailed injuries on Cherise's scalp, her chest, legs, her arms, her neck, her chin, her lip, her nose, her eyes, obviously her genitals, and her throat. And she does this to explain to the court exactly what those injuries are. Look, Cherish had suffered some horrific injuries. She really had. There were abrasions and contusions all over her body, and that was because of the sexual assault and the torture that she went through. There was blunt force trauma to the back of her head and her face. She had a bite mark to her right breast, and she had ligature marks around her neck. She was strangled with such force that her eyeballs had bled, because obviously the blood is trying to get to the brain, and if you've cut off the opportunity for the oxygen to go there, that's when we see all of this kind of bleeding into areas that you shouldn't bleed. There was also blood vessels in the throat, the face, the nose and the eyes that had burst. She'd suffered the most horrific trauma to her genitals. She'd basically been torn apart. And the pathologist said this: she had so much trauma, the anatomy was totally distorted by the injury she suffered. When she was asked to describe the internal injuries to Cherish's throat, the pathologist actually had to take a breath. She couldn't answer it, and she asked for a 5-minute recess. This drives me mad. The defence at this point are like, oh, hang on a minute. I think we can do something here. I think this is a mistrial. Really, do you? I do. I think it's a mistrial. Why is it a mistrial? I think it's a mistrial because the pathologist struggled to talk about the horrific injuries to this defenseless child, and that makes her unprofessional. She's biased the jury to make them think it's heinous that they'll find him guilty. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense that the really guilty guy who did this horrible stuff to this innocent child, that the pathologist is now struggling to explain because of what he did, means that she's now messed up the trial and he should definitely not be tried for it anymore. I know that you need a defence. I appreciate that defence needs to be there because at times innocent people get into situations where they need people to look after them, right? But at no point in any kind of bizarre fantasy world can I imagine that it would be acceptable to try to get off on a technicality, because if that person got off, you would be putting back into the community a child murderer who has no capacity to manage his emotions and is so depraved that he would undoubtedly go on to cause even more death and destruction to other children. But that's what they try. They claim that the pathologist's emotional reaction had irreparably prejudiced the jury. And the court were like, it begins with an F. Second word's O. They didn't do that. They did just deny it. But I think that they were thinking what I've just said in my head, and that you know I mean, in that moment, that's what they would genuinely have been wanting to say. But they're like, do one. Literally, do one. The prosecutors tell the jury, Cherish did not die quickly. She didn't die easily. In fact, hers was a brutal and tortured death. That little girl, that child, she put up a fight. She really did. She was a little girl, slight. And she fought. She had defensive wounds to her arms, to her hands. And that's testament to the fact that she put up a fight. He had scratches on his face, didn't he? They actually concluded that it would have taken about 5 minutes for her to die whilst being strangled, which is a horrific thing to know. But it also demonstrates that little girl's fire, you know? It's heartbreaking. But she fought for her life. She bit him. She injured him. She got material down her nails. She did everything to let him know that she did not want what he was doing and that her life had meaning to her. And I think that that says something powerful about this little girl, this lovely, kind, compassionate little girl that everybody knew had a smile that could light up any room. And yet in that moment, wow, she went down fighting. And I have such respect for her. Any of us listening right now would stop what happened to her, would bring her back to the arms of her loved family. We can't do that, but we can respect what she did in those 5 moments. We can respect it. There's also a shedload of forensic evidence that the prosecution have that confirmed that Smith's DNA had been both in and on Cherish's body. So a crime lab analyst had actually managed to state that the odds of the DNA belonging to someone else were, wait for it, 1 in 35 quintillion. Yeah, quintillion. Jeff Bezos probably knows what that is, but for us mere mortals, it's 35 followed by 30 zeros. Yeah, it ain't gonna be pinned on anybody else. This is definitely this guy. And Cherish's DNA was also strikingly found on his penis. So he's banged to rights beyond belief. The jury were also allowed to view footage which showed him leaving the Walmart store with Cherish and actually leading her into his van. Also, they heard lots of damning evidence. This is from a couple that Smith spoke to in the Walmart parking lot. So they'd seen him doing it. And shoppers who saw Smith with Cherish, and actually a former Walmart security guard as well, talked about the fact that he'd seen him. So it was clear that they had the right guy. But, and this is awful to listen to, and I have listened to it, but it's just his voice when he says it that really provokes something guttural within me. It's not just the content of what he's saying, it's how he's saying it. Because they did some secret recordings of Smith in prison, and they play these to the jury. That's right up my alley, right there. That's my target area. I'd like to run into her at Walmart. He then added, Cherish had a butt on her. She had a lot for a white girl. The only target that I wish we were talking about right now is one on his head. But that's not a guy showing remorse, is it? It's not a perpetrator who's realised the error of their horrible ways. It's not an individual repentant. He's celebrating. How dare he mention Cherish's name? Literally. How dare he be allowed to speak her name without some kind of horrible repercussion? He makes a phone call to his mother as well, and he asks her to bring in a copy of a guide to mental illnesses, because obviously this man who clearly knows that he's going to be sentenced, thinks to himself, how can I get away with this? Maybe I can use an insanity defense. So what he wanted to do was to practice acting mentally ill in court. He also, in this phone call, says that he hopes to get the death penalty. And the reason for that is he's afraid that other inmates were going to kill him. I think he's got a pretty appropriate assumption there. Don't think the inmates are the only people who feel similarly. Now, during the trial, Smith puts forward absolutely no defence. He presented no witnesses. Yeah. So, when you're in court, your job with your defence team is to create one, you know, so that the jury make a decision based on what they've heard, so it's balanced. He put nobody on the stand. There was no defence to be argued, and he did it for one reason. He wanted to put Cherish's family through that ordeal. He knew he wasn't going to win, but he wanted them to be punished. It took the jury less than 15 minutes. Yeah, I mean, I kind of have a deep respect for that jury. You know, I always think that in these cases, sometimes the jury will feel like they have to kind of look like they've considered that there is a possibility this individual is innocent or there has been some kind of misrepresentation and therefore they're not going to find them guilty of the charge. But these were just like, shall we even go to the recess room? I think we should just say it unanimously now. Guilty. So he gets guilty after 15 minutes. And at the penalty phase of the trial, they all agreed there was only one sentence that was acceptable, and that was death. When the judge came to looking at the aggravating factors in this case, wow, they were just so serious. So he's got previous convictions for sex offences. The murder itself involved kidnapping and sexual assault. The nature of the crime was especially heinous, atrocious, cruel. The victim was just 8 years old, so ultimately the death sentence was literally inevitable. And I, as you know, in the UK, am relatively glad that we don't have a death penalty because I know things can go wrong. But in this case, I don't feel conflicted that this man has been told that he'll be put to death. Whilst he was incarcerated, Smith actually had a discussion with his mother and he did confess what he did, but guess what he did? He decided that the way he wanted this whole crime to be perceived was not how it had been perceived in the public. He wanted it to be viewed as a violent crime. So he reckoned that he'd snapped and he'd just been really rageful and violent to Cherish, and that's how he'd killed her. He didn't want people viewing her in the way that we view her as a victim of child molestation and murder. He didn't want people to think that he'd used her sexually. He didn't want to be viewed as a paedophile. He didn't find that something that was going to work for him. But of course, everybody knows he is. Everybody believes that he is. And whether his mother has wanted to buy into that delusion and illusion, well, that's for her to have a conversation with her maker in the end. But certainly, it doesn't matter which way he plays it. He raped that child and he murdered that child. Full stop. End of. In April 2021, Smith appealed his conviction. Of course he did, because he's a massive psychopathic, narcissistic murderer. But he claims that he didn't have a fair trial. You didn't have a fair trial. You didn't even put your own defense up. You didn't have any witnesses. You literally had nobody in your area to support you because nobody supports you. He reckoned that the jury were biased due to the news coverage. He said that the emotional reaction of the pathologist had prejudiced the jury. He said that the admission of the autopsy photos had unduly influenced and unfairly influenced jurors. And therefore, his appeal was dismissed. It was dismissed. They were like, oh, how long did the jury take to decide that they weren't going to do anything but find him guilty? 15 minutes. How long have I been looking at this appeal? 8 seconds. Refused. I imagine it went something like that. I wish I was a fly on the wall in those circumstances. This case obviously provoked a huge amount of reaction because, my God, we care about children and we hate it when a child is taken in the way that this girl was taken. And following Cherish's death, her mother actually received a huge amount of criticism. And I know you are watching this and you may, some of you, agree that she deserves that kind of criticism. You may feel that allowing her to go off with a stranger was the most stupid, unforgivable mistake that she could have ever made. I appreciate that might be your thoughts. I equally want you all to know that wherever you are on the spectrum, the reason that we feel these feelings so strongly is because we care about this little girl. It should never have happened. But when they're online suggesting that it was actually her own fault for letting her daughter go off with this stranger, saying that she should be charged, we have to remember that Smith was the sexual predator here. You know, his history clearly demonstrates that he's able to carefully select, stalk, manipulate his victims. He was able to quickly identify that Rain and her kids were vulnerable. They were available targets. That's how sexual predators operate. You know, Rain was clearly struggling. She was struggling financially. She'd previously been homeless. Smith had managed to manipulate her. He gained her trust. He knew that they were down on their luck and he wanted to exploit that. He wanted to be like the good Samaritan. Brain later reflected and said, you know, I thought he was nice. I thought he was kind. And to anyone who saw Smith and Cherish leave that store, they would genuinely have just looked like granddad and granddaughter. And like I said earlier, Cherish would probably have felt safe getting back into Smith's van. She'd been with him earlier. She'd been in the van safely before. Her mother and siblings had been there. Remember, this guy that I'm talking about now, this is the same man who had previously convinced a grandmother that he worked for child services and got her to take her own granddaughter to McDonald's for an examination. So this guy is good at getting people to believe him. I'm the first to not defend the indefensible, but when you think about the fact that people are genuinely laying the same amount of blame at Rain's doorstep as they are to a child molesting murderers, I think we have to realize that that is skewed and it comes from an emotional place because we care deeply about what happened to this kid and we wanted it to be avoided. So we control our world by believing that we would never be in a situation like that. We need to berate that human being because they led to actions that equated to a breach of safety for that child that led to something catastrophic. So I get it, but I also get that that woman has suffered a blow so devastating, so life-changing, that she'll likely never recover. When people have been asked about Rain as a mother, they say she was a protected mum. Her boyfriend said that she was one of those people who would go without so that she could buy things for her daughters instead. Look, she was really naive, but ultimately she was still a victim in this. The only guilty party in this scenario was Smith. Rain is going to have to go on to live the rest of her life with the guilt of letting her daughter leave with a man who raped and tortured her. It's easy to blame her because, hey, we all want to imagine, like I said, that it could never possibly happen to us. But she's going to punish herself for the rest of her life every single day. And for other people to punish her, they don't need to. She lives it. She breathes it. She always will. When she lost Cherish, everything changed because she also lost custody of her other two daughters. They were actually adopted by a relative in Rain's native Australia. I looked it up as far as the child protection report and it said that she didn't manage to fulfill the obligations that they set up for her. I will note that that does not mean that she was failing as a mother. Sometimes there are obligations that are placed in a document that are actually very difficult for people to achieve. And I will also note that when I watch the video footage of her and her children, I do not see anything but happy kids. I also feel that my deepest hope is that those children are thriving in Australia, because to be taken away from your mother after losing your sister is something psychologically deeply traumatizing. So I hope that their life is great. But I certainly don't think that's a happy ending. I don't think that those kids have got a happy ending, no matter how the press try to spin it, and spin it they do, if you look at reports of that. No disrespect to the family in Australia. I'm sure that they've scooped those girls up. I'm sure that they're trying to make their lives the most beautiful lives that they could be. But losing your primary carer, your mother, it's debilitating for many. When I think about what happened to Cherish in this case, I can't help but thinking the crime that played out was really reminiscent of the 2009 abduction and murder of 7-year-old Summer Thomas. And she, similarly, she just vanished while she was walking home from school. And the police found her body in a Georgia landfill. She'd been sexually assaulted and strangled. They did get the guy who did it. It was 24-year-old Jared Harrell. He was arrested and convicted. Again, though, he had this history of offences against children. It kind of like really provokes something, because it's like, we need to monitor these molesters. We need to know where they are. We need to be aware of where they are living, walking, working, because we have to be able to protect these children. earlier on, I talked about the fact that Cherish had a very much loved father, Billy, and he didn't actually go to the sentencing hearing. And the reason that he didn't go to that sentencing hearing is probably the most honest representation that I can align myself with regarding how he felt inside. He said that if he went, he was afraid of what he might do if he was in the same room as his daughter's killer. I think probably all of us listening right now feel like we might not know what we would have done if we had been in that room and we weren't even related to this kid. And what he said was, she had a good life ahead of her and would probably have been very successful at something, but we'll never know now. No, it's not justice. The legal system works the way it works, but he's been living for 5 years after the death of my daughter, and he's going to be living until the death penalty is done or whatever the case may be. And that's not justice. She didn't get that option to live those many years. She was 8.5 years old and she was taken away that night. I don't think there is a way to have justice in something like this. Really strong, powerful words. And for me, that makes perfect sense. This idea of the injustice that the family feel, that that predator is kept warm and safe and fed and allowed to continue a journey that he refused to allow a little girl to do. That in itself is always going to feel so out of balance. I genuinely feel that she will have been scooped up in the arms of the big beautiful beyond and will be safe now. But she should have been on this planet. She should have been living her life fully, thriving, growing, developing, experiencing all the things that she deserved, from meeting boyfriends, getting married, having kids, watching her mother grow old, all the things that so many of us take for granted. It's horrific to even try to conceive what Cherish Periwinkle went through in those final moments. And what is terrifying is there is an avoidability to what occurred. Smith should not have been walking the streets. Smith should have been monitored constantly if he was allowed on those streets. Smith should not have been allowed near children. There should have been a system where he was prevented from having any kind of access. Those psychological reports should have been taken seriously. He should never have been allowed out of prison in the first place without lots of therapy. He was mentally disordered and a risk to children all the way back then. Instead, not only was he allowed to walk free, people didn't follow up when he was looking inappropriately in stores, filming people. He was just allowed to carry on to a point where he abducted and murdered a child after carrying out the most torturous impact on her body. And still, he's breathing. Still, he's eating. Still, he's living. There are failures beyond doubt from the fact that, as I said, he had that freedom to do all the things that I've just talked about. But secondly, that when Rain told the police, they just didn't take it seriously. Like anyone has a right to make a judgment call when a child goes missing per se.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.